I'm up on the tight wire.
Good morning. I'm Daniel Chacon, and welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Benjamin Alida Sines couldn't be with us today, but we still have a great show for you. I was walking around AWP at the book fair last year in Chicago, and I went to the Pitts Poetry Series booth, and I bought a couple of books, and one of those was called Ka-Ching, and it's written by Denise DeHummel, and I love the book so much, I had to have her on the show, so she's going to be joining us today, and we're going to talk about this fantastic book. So stick around, and we'll talk to Denise DeHummel. Denise DeHummel is the author of Ka-Ching, a selection of the Pitt Poetry Series. And today we're going to talk about that book and whatever else comes up. The poet Edward Field wrote about DeHummel, "More than any other poet I know, Denise DeHummel, for all the witty, polished surface of her poems, communicates the ache of human existence." And I think this is a perfect way to describe her work. It takes a poet to describe a poet. This book, Ka-Ching, which in itself is just fun to say, Ka-Ching. I would recommend buying the book just so you can say, I read Ka-Ching. But it really is, quite frankly, it's a very painful book. There's a certain poem that's come to mind in the Play Money section where the speaker of the poem loses her jacket in a movie theater. And believe it or not, it's painful. It's a painful poem. And throughout all the humor, you kind of feel the stab at not having a lot. Coming from working class background, being I don't even want to say a poor poet, but just coming from that background and having living within a culture that encourages material wealth. But I had to ask myself, how could I feel so much for someone who lost a jacket? And as I read her poems, as I read Ka-Ching, I think this is the kind of poetry I admire. We're very happy to have you on the show. Thank you, Denise, for showing up.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's talk about Ka-Ching.
Okay.
How do you feel about this book vis-a-vis all your other books?
Well, I think this book, for me, sometimes I write in series. You know, I know what the book's going to be eventually, and sometimes I don't. And then I just write for a couple of years and then try to look back to see what I was mm-hmm. doing. And it didn't occur to me that I was writing so much about money or that kept coming up over and over and over, even though I wrote those prose poems that are actually shaped like mm-hmm. dollar bills. It still didn't sort of occur to me. So then when I looked at the work I'd been writing for the past couple of years, that was the one thing. I was like, this work isn't connecting at all. It's all over the place. But then I realized it had this currency, if you will, through it of cash, money, and consumerism, and winning and losing, too. I mean, this whole idea of the word Ka-Ching can mean a windfall, like at a slot machine, Ka-Ching, but it can also mean putting out a lot of money. I just got my Visa bill, Ka-Ching. I mean, it can be both. You know, it can be both. And I was sort of interested in sort of the luck of why certain people are born rich, why certain people are born poor, you know, just a whole lottery of life, if you will.
That first section you referred to, it's called Play Money. You're referring to that. And these are prose poems that are fit inside of a dollar bill. In fact, you have to turn the book sideways in order to read them. What I really like about these pieces is that they're so loose in the sense that the language just seems to be able to go anywhere, yet they're mm-hmm. so contained inside mm-hmm. these dollar bills and really kind of so precise in their language. And I think that's a really nice tension about this book is it seems so loose, like it could do anything, yet at the same time it seems so focused. Is that something you had to work on hard?
Actually, in a way it was, because I was sort of thinking of that American dream, like, you can do anything, you go girl, but you really can't. I mean, yes, in theory, I suppose, but, you know, the constraints of where we're born, I mean, it is sort of this, the American dream. I mean, I guess it's, you know, you look at someone, yes, like one out of a million people can, but it's all luck and weirdness in a way as well. You know, yes, it is your self-determination and your chutzpah and all that, but it's also, you know, there's a lot of blocks along the way. So I really found these at a thrift store, these Play Money, and they're $100,000 bills each. And so I wrote the poem. They really exist I actually wrote them on the back of the I put them in my printer sideways, do you know what I mean? So they uh-huh. actually occur. And it was so interesting to me because it really was, as you say, you know, it can go anywhere, but not really, because I was determined to make all those poems the same exact size, the same exact length, the same exact, you know, I would have to put in an adjective to make it go the last line all the way. You know, you change one word and everything would change. So it was really fun to do. It was started out as a visual poetry project. And I was so happy that Pitt was able to include it in the book as I wanted it to. I mean, they could just be in prose blocks too, but I was really happy. The designer was very patient with me and trying to recreate them.
We're talking about the book Ka-Ching by Denise DeHommel, which is a book of poems. There's a lot of prose poems in there too. The book is tied together nicely with the poem 9/11, 2003. It's a chilling poem about an accident. In fact, I think the first line begins with the speaker of the phone getting a phone call from her sister and says, "There's been an accident." This ties the poem together beautifully. I mean, not just thematically, but in imagistically and in so many ways. Can you tell us a little bit about the accident and where the source of this came from?
Sure. I mean, it came, unfortunately, from real life.
My
my parents did suffer in September 10th, 2003. They took one of those bus trips. They live in New England and in Rhode Island, and they took a bus trip to Atlantic City. And they were on an escalator, one of those giant escalators that goes for two floors, and the thing malfunctioned, and all these people toppled backwards. And my mother, both of my parents were hurt terribly, and my mother especially was disfigured. I mean, it was this horrible, completely horrible thing. And my mom was in surgery overnight, so no one called, no doctor called. And my dad was in the same hospital, but they were in different units. Because my dad had suffered a heart attack, and so he was on the heart unit, and my mother had been physically hurt, so she was on a different unit. And it was just this, I mean, it was brutal and horrible. And because it happened in the casino, it was even worse somehow, because it was connected to this, like, sleaziness, you know what I mean? It was really awful. So I think I'm writing about my parents, and I was very interested in, like, the way their bodies had suffered and what happened to them that was so horrific and, you know, quote-unquote a freak accident. And I thought I was writing about what it was like to take care of parents who had suffered. But then when I realized that it was took place in a casino and that there was this really sleazy lawsuit and, you know, it was just, oh, it was awful. It made it worse, you know?
What do you think about the question, are you a political poet? How do you feel about that question?
I think I am a political poet, and I'm not afraid of a label at all. I know that a lot of times, I've tried to ask this of other poets, and they always say no. They're like,
or they get mad at the question.
Yeah, I'm like, what do you mean? But I really feel like, I don't mind the label at all, and I do feel like I am a political poet, and I feel like it's my only way to fight back. I mean, the frustration of it all is, it's too much. I mean, it's really too much. And so I think for me, poetry is a way to sort of at least address it and at least humanize, maybe put a human face on what happens when corporations act so irresponsibly. I mean, we know it in theory. We know it. I mean, we read it, but then to actually have it, to put faces on it, I think makes it interesting, you know, and even more horrifying.
I was wondering if you would be kind enough to read a poem for us, either something from Ka-Ching. One of the things that you do in the book a lot, which I think shows your sense of humor, is you play with forms. You don't take them too seriously, but you kind of play with them a little bit. And I'm thinking in particular of two poems, Anagram America, which has the word America in every line, but mixed up in such a way that they become other words like A Crime, A Camera, I Acme, Ira, but they all end in America. And it's really kind of an interesting play with form. It's almost as if the form itself is not sacred and needs to be made fun of a bit. We have this segment on Words on a Wire called Poem of the Day. And I was hoping you would be able to read one of those poems where you kind of have fun with the form. And I'm thinking particularly of Delta Flight 659, which is a poem that you dedicated to Sean Penn, the actor. And it's really interesting because even though you lose track of it, because the poem is, the language is just so, the rhythm and the language works so effectively, you kind of lose track of it. But every single line ends with the word pen. How did this one come about?
Well, actually, I'm a sort of a nervous flyer, and I was writing. I had this idea
with
for
a pen?
Poem. Yeah, so I actually wrote a lot of this on the plane, and I thought, I would love to write a Sestina. And then I went to write a Sestina, and I thought, I have no idea the order of the words. You know what I mean? Because in a traditional Sestina, there's six end words that permeate all through the poem. And I didn't have a Sestina with me, and I thought, oh, I could just use the same word over and over and over and be really blunt. So I chose the word pen because I was thinking about this Sean Penn incident, and he was in a magazine I was reading. I was reading one of those trashy magazines. And then also, you know, of course, Penn, the writer. So, yeah, every single N-word has pen embedded in its word.
And so you really penned the first draft of this on a plane.
I did.
Excellent. Then let's hear Delta Flight 659. We're going to go ahead and turn it over to you for Poem of the Week. We welcome Denise DeHommel.
Thank you. Delta Flight 659 to Sean Penn. I'm writing this on a plane, Sean Penn, with my black Pilot Razor ballpoint pen. Ever since 9/11, I'm a nervous flyer. I leave my Pentium processor in Florida so TSA can't x-ray my stanzas penetrate my persona. Maybe this should be an iambic pentameter rather than this mock Sestina, each line ending in a pen variant. I convinced myself the ticket to Baghdad was too expensive. I contemplated going as a human shield. I read in open-mouth shock that your trip there was a $56,000 expenditure. Is that true? I watched you on Larry King Live, his suspenders and tie, your open collar. You saw the war's impending mess. My husband gambled on my penumbra of doubt. So you station yourself at a food silo in Iraq. What happens to me if you get blown up? He begged me to stay home, to be his Penelope. I sit alone in coach, but last night I sat with four poets, depending on one another as readers in a Pittsburgh cafe. I tried to be your pen pal in 1987, not because of your pensive bad boy looks, but because of a poem you penned that appeared in an issue of Frank. I still see the poet in you, Sean Penn. You probably think fans like me are your penance for your popularity, your star bulging into a pentagon filled with witchy wannabes and penniless poets who waddle towards your icy peninsula of glamour like so many menacing penguins. But honest, I come in peace, Sean Penn, writing on my plane ride home. I want no part of your penthouse or the snowy slopes of your aspen. I won't stalk you like the swirling grime cloud over Pigpen. I have no script or stupendous novel I want you to option. I even like your wife, Robin Wright Penn. I only want to keep myself busy on this flight to tell you of four penny loafered poets in Pennsylvania who last night, chomping on primavera, penne pasta, pondered poetry, celebrity, Iraq, the penitentiary of free speech, and how I reminded everyone that Sean Penn once wrote a poem. I peer out the window, caress my lucky pendant. Look, Sean Penn, the clouds drawn with charcoal pencils. The sky is opening like a child's first stab at penmanship. The sun begins to ripen orange, then deepen.
Delta Flight 659 from Kaching by Denise DeHommel. Thank you for sharing that poem with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I am going to reveal a little secret, which many of you may have guessed to begin with, and that is that we don't always record the poetic license and the interview on the same day. And the Denise DeHommel interview was a couple of days ago. However, I found out this weekend that my father died. It was somewhat of a surprise. So my poetic license today is dedicated to my father. And you know us writers, we feel something, we got to share it right away. So here it is. This is to my father, Richard Chacon. I kind of feel like I should dedicate something to my father. Write about him, maybe, because I was alone when I heard the news. Alone, I guess, with my two dogs and cat. And I started pacing the floors thinking, wow, my father's dead. It occurred to me how such a significant event in my day, in my week, in my life could be meaningless to others, not because they're insensitive jerks, but because he's not their father, and quite frankly, he died alone. He has us, his children, my brothers and sister, and he has 10 grandchildren, but he died alone because he didn't like or trust any of us. He didn't seem to want us around, and he often chose solitude over family. One Christmas day, which by the way was also his birthday, we were gathered at Ricky's house, and there were kids running all around and food piled on the table and the kitchen counters, a feast of meats and cheesy potatoes. I brought a couple of bottles of wine, but I was the only one drinking. Everyone else was laughing, sharing stories of our past, memories of our mother. And my father sat wrapped in a blanket like he was cold, sitting on a leather chair, brooding, looking so sad. At a lull in the conversation, he said to me, "I'm depressed." "Why?" I asked. "You have no kids," he said. "We have no family." I looked around, all the kids playing and screaming with delight, his sons and daughters sitting around and truly enjoying each other's company. I invited him to see what I was seeing. Ezekiel, Marina, Cruz, all his beautiful grandchildren, little Ricky, Evan, Aaron. Like an evangelical, I wanted to show him that the reality he created of loneliness and isolation and pain and regret wasn't real. God says to Abraham, after Lot had parted from him, "Lift up your eyes from where you are and look north and south and east and west. All this belongs to you." Abraham, of course, was the patriarch, and my father, our patriarch, I wanted him to look up and see all that had been given to him, all sides, all the children, the family that loves him, but he wouldn't see it. I think he liked me, or I should say tolerated me, and often seemed happy to see me, but only because in his eyes I was a famous writer. My accomplishments were no more significant than those of my siblings, but from his apparent perspective, there was something that separated me from them. The fact that they lived in Fresno, where he lived. I was 1,000 miles away, literally, in the West Texas desert from where he came. My siblings were there when he needed them. I wasn't. I was away, and during my breaks as a university professor, I would go to Argentina, Mexico, Cuba, Poland. "Where are you going next, my son?" I remember the first time I went to Paris, I called him from El Paso before my flight and said, "Guess what, Dad, I'm going to Paris." "What for?" he asked. Because I want to see it," I said. "I need to get my car fixed," he said. "Kenny needs to come and get me. He's late." He lived alone in the house where I grew up, but he didn't know how to maintain a functioning household. He let things get out of hand, weeds in the yard, junk in piles on the driveway. So when the city threatened to cite him and condemn the house as unlivable, my siblings came to rescue his home. They arrived with buckets and mops and cleaning liquids that hurt in the head when you smell them too closely. They cleaned and piled and tossed, and all along my father watched them work and seemed to hate them for their love. I left Fresno decades ago when I went to graduate school at the University of Oregon, and other than short trips home to visit or to do readings at the colleges in the city, I never went back. Whenever I had a book presentation at the university, my dad would bring his girlfriend of the time or some woman he was courting, and he'd show me off. He'd buy her a copy of my book and have me sign it to her. He was proud of me, and because I wasn't geographically close enough to help him as he deteriorated into dementia, he never lashed out at me. Did he love me? I don't know. I know that I loved him. I know that this summer, Sasha and I went to visit him in a home, where he ended up for a few weeks because he was unable to care for himself. I know he often forgot who I was, and he called me Kenny, and a few times he thought Sasha was Marina, and Marina was Sandy. I showed him family pictures, and he glowed looking at the ones of my young mother, how beautiful she was. Then he went off on how she got selfish and left him for a dream that was a lie of romantic movies and TV commercials and Cosmopolitan magazine. He wouldn't see it, the way his children loved him. He died alone, emotionally and physically too, in a bed, in a home. He couldn't take care of himself and refused to be taken care of by his children, my siblings who cleaned his home and made sure he took his medication, who had to take his car keys away because he would drive to some random place and forget he had a car and would walk home wondering what had happened to it. He would get in accidents and not know it. They had to keep him alive, but he acted like he hated them. Maybe he thought they wanted the car for themselves, an old model Monte Carlo, so musty and thick inside that you couldn't breathe in there. My sister called me with the news. She said, "Your father died." They were at the hospital and were about to see him, meaning they were about to view the body that used to be my handsome young father. He was handsome. He had a look about him. When my sister hung up, I walked back and forth by myself in my house. Sasha was out at the climbing gym. Kafka and Sonnet, our dogs, watched me pace back and forth. Joey, our cat, was ripping at some grocery bag I had left on the table, shredding it to his delight, not for what was inside, but because he likes to shred paper. I thought, my father's dead. Dad's dead. "How do you feel about this, Danny?" That's what people call me at home. My father always called me Danny. To say I'm sad doesn't seem to say much. I hadn't talked to him for almost a month, and no one has had a conversation with him in years. About a month before he died, Sandy called. She was with Dad, she said, spending the night with him, and he was angry at everyone, yelling and being mean in a way only he could be mean. She handed me the phone, perhaps thinking my voice might calm him down. "Hi, Dad," I said. "How are you?" "Really bad," he said. "Very, very bad." He told me how they took his keys, and he was going to call the police, and oh boy, were they in for trouble when the law gets involved, and he needs his car, and what if there's an emergency, and how's he going to get groceries, get to the grocery store to buy his stuff? I tried to tell him that his children are taking care of him, and they will take him anywhere he needs to go. For about 10 minutes, he kept telling me in circles the same thing that made him so mad, his keys. "They better give me my bleeping keys, or they'll be sorry." He had been diagnosed with severe dementia, and he no longer had the right to drive. But he didn't know what was happening. He didn't know the live-in nurses my siblings hired to stay in his house with him were not his wives. He seemed to love them more than he loved his children, the ones who hired them. As for the grandchildren, a small child left him cold. The time I spoke to him before that, he spoke in circles, and before that, circles, and so many circles he spoke, but he could not have a conversation, and he sometimes forgot who he was talking to. I can't say I'm going to miss my father, at least not the version of him who died alone. So how do I feel? I wanted to believe that as Richard Chacon died, his ego crumbled into tiny pieces and fell to the floor, and what came out of the shell of his former self was the light of his soul. His ego was tremendous, like a lot of people's ego, and maybe that part of him took over in his aging. But when he was young, my father, his glow, his spirit was so beautiful. Like all men and women, he was beautiful. He wanted to be an artist. He took photos, lots of them, and he had all the best camera equipment, light meters, lenses, tripods, and he was good at it. Some of his photos are professional quality, so talented. He built his own darkroom in our garage, and he developed pictures there. I remember standing with him in the darkroom, the glow of a soft blue light on his skin as he held up a piece of dripping photo paper, and we watched in amazement how over the hours the image became more and more clear. My young mother, her blonde hair up in a bouffant, and she's wearing a pretty blue dress, low cut, and she's at a formal dinner party, holding a fork halfway to her mouth, and she's looking into the camera at my father, the photographer. Such a beautiful shot, such a beautiful woman. He loved a good image, and he was smart. In his early 30s, he would come home every night from work, throw his hard hat and lunchbox on the couch, eat dinner, watch the news, and then he sat all night long at the table and taught himself calculus. For years, he sat at that table teaching himself math. He used to give me lectures on math. How elegant it was, so precise, such fearful symmetry. He got chills when he understood a beautiful equation. He loved it. When I was a kid, my father was an inventor. His workshop was the garage. He invented a bike that would pedal by itself, a flycatcher out of wood and screen, a photo booth where a Polaroid camera took your picture and placed it on a t-shirt. He built a computer before there were personal computers. He was young in spirit, so full of hope and light, so full of good ideas. He was a creator, and his light was contagious. Kenny and I are writers. My sister is a photographer trying to escape. Ricky carves images into wood and clay. But as he got older, that creator part of my father gave way to the other part of him, the part that caused my mom to leave him, that caused him to go from woman to woman, all of them leaving him for the same reasons. I wonder, as I pace the floor of my house, the dogs watching me, silent, knowing I'm feeling serious emotions, dogs know. The only sound in the house, Joey biting at the paper bag, I wonder how his spirit left his body. Some mystics believe that when we die, unless we're prepared to die, we don't know we're dead. They believe that intense solipsism ensues, where the only reality the dead see is the one their will creates. The dead might see a landscape, a city, a house, a bedroom, and they think they are there, but they are imagining it at all. These things they see come from their ruling emotion, their ruling concerns at the time of death. If they die afraid, they might see something that will make them fear, maybe an inner city street with robbers and thieves, the city of the dead. If they die in peace, they might see some beautiful landscape, rolling green hills like images of Ireland, maybe a single tree on top of one. Now, I'm not saying this is true, but if it were, I would hope my father didn't die angry or hateful. I hope that when he died, that part of him crumbled away like clay and fell in chunks to the ground, and what rose from his body was the light of the young man who loved to take photos, who loved the elegance of a mathematical equation. I hope it's that man. I hope that's the part of the soul that creates what he sees, where he is right now, even as I utter these inadequate words. I hope he sees his beautiful equations transposed over the landscape, as if every tree, every rock, every flower, every pretty woman standing in a doorway welcoming him home were a flurry of numbers and symbols, some equation, and he could finally figure out how much his children loved him, how beautiful were his grandchildren. As I look out the window of our home, looking onto the beautiful green of the trees in our yard, the yellow flowers dangling from the Palo Verde, I hope that what my father sees is as beautiful as this. I hope by some miracle, some grace of God, some turn of the cosmic screw, all that's ugly about the way he sees the world shingles off him like shattered glass. Sasha gets home from the climbing gym, wearing tights and sucking on a bottle of water, her bangs sticking to her forehead. "Great climb," she says. I tell her the news. She jumps into my arms, puts her head onto my chest and weeps, and the sun falls. We talk about him. She says maybe, at the moment of his death, he was eating Jell-O, maybe cherry-flavored, and maybe he loved the taste so much and enjoyed it so much that all he felt was elation, the glow of happiness, and in that way he died. Maybe he was remembering something about my mother, who loved him so much because my young father was so passionate, so smart, so creative, and she loved him so much. Maybe, at the moment of his death, he was remembering something about her, about them. Maybe the first time he saw her, walking to school with her sisters, holding her books, wearing a poodle skirt, her hair glowing red in the sunlight. And when the light of death overtook him, maybe he gladly walked into it, soul first, leaving the old man behind, becoming part of the light of love, dissolving into the presence of love. Thank you for joining us for another edition of Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank Denise DeHummel for being on our show. Don't forget, pick up Ka-Ching. And join us next week, 11:30 a.m. every Sunday on KTEP 88.5. And don't forget, the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire.